Rebo, thanks for talking with me.
Pleasure to be here.
It's great to have you. Do you remember a first meeting with Bonnie Raitt? First time you laid eyes on her or heard her?
I do remember my first meeting with Bonnie. In fact, it was at a psychedelic dungeon in Philadelphia called the Electric Factory. And I was playing with a band called the Edison Electric Band. We were opening for Procol Harum. And I believe it was 1968. And a fellow named Dick Waterman, who managed Buddy Guy and Junior Wells and Arthur Big Boy Crudup and Son House and Mississippi Fred McDowell, a bunch of blues guys, was interested in managing us. And we were kind of a funky, psychedelic blues band, early kind of a jam band, and we had made some noise in Philadelphia. And he came down to see us and bring his girlfriend, a freshman in Radcliffe, to come and give him her opinion of us. And it was a young Bonnie Raitt, an 18-year-old Bonnie Raitt, I believe. And turns out she really liked the band, and she really liked me, and she liked the way I played the bass. And I remember her. She was a bright-eyed, redhead, very, very vivacious, very outgoing, big smile, beautiful dimples, very buxom. And I mean, she was a trip. She was just very bright, very bright, and very appealing on a lot of levels. And that was my first meeting with her, and we became friends, and she and Dick would come and visit the band. We got a house near Princeton, New Jersey, because we were making our first record for Atlantic Records in New York, and same time we were doing the music for the NFL films for the 50th anniversary of pro football. So Philadelphia and New York, right in between, was Princeton, and they used to come up and visit us at the farm. And
cool. How about the first time seeing her with a guitar in hand?
Well, the first time I saw her with a guitar was
Try that again with Bonnie for me.
Oh, the first time I saw Bonnie with a guitar was at the Second Fret in Philadelphia. It wasn't maybe 6 months after I had met her at the Electric Factory. And I remember it was a full house, and she was sitting on a chair, and she was completely self-effacing. She said, "Oh, I can't believe you come. Oh, I'm so terrible. I'm just unbelievably self-effacing and unbelievably beautiful, just singing like a bird." But what was really amazing about Bonnie, especially, you know, she had this beautiful, sweet voice, but she would sing, and she was between folk and blues at that time. And when she'd go to blues, and even within the folk, she would bend notes in a bluesy fashion. So it really put an edge on the sweetness. And of course, she had a trained voice. I mean, a combination of inheriting her voice from her father, who probably had the greatest of all voices in musical comedy and in the live stage thing in the musical genre. So I think she probably inherited that from her, and I think she also from him, and I think she also learned some technique from him as well, and picked up stuff by osmosis. But it was an amazing show, and then I would see her in Dick's office in Philadelphia, and often in Dick's office, a buddy would be hanging out there, Junior, Mississippi Fred, Arthur, a lot of these guys, a lot of the blues guys, and Bonnie would be there literally picking their brains and sitting with a guitar and learning exactly what they were doing and picking up the nuances. So she listened to the records, and she listened to the blues and to rhythm and blues, but she also met and hung out with the guys who did it. So she was meticulous in how she picked up the guitar nuances and the vocal nuances. And I think that's why when you hear Bonnie, why she sounds so genuine. She doesn't sound like a white girl singing the blues. And the blues is a very specific musical genre, and it's really as much what you do between the notes, sliding, slurs, and that's what really gives it its emotion. And that's what she really picked up, and Bonnie's a very emotional person, so She would always choose, and still does, choose the songs that are very close to her heart, things that she can relate to. And so she takes the emotion of the lyrics and puts in the bluesy nuances, and it just really pulls on your heartstrings. I don't think there's anybody in music who delivers a song and really taps into the emotion of a song and communicates the emotion of a song better than Bonnie Raitt.
Some of the things you're talking about must have been among the things that when she first started recording, and you were there on the very first album and several afterwards. The question, I guess, would be a variation on what you started to describe there. What do you think was so appealing about Bonnie Raitt to the music audience in the early 1970s, you know, in comparison to what else was available? And what do you think was standing out about her sound, any part of what was part of that?
Well, this is not racist, but this is just realistic. She was probably the first white girl. And it's not sexist either, but at the time, this is the late 60s, very early 70s, 71 when she made her first CD, first record, excuse me, okay. when I started working with her, but when I first heard her, she was the first white girl that I had heard, and basically anybody had heard, who played guitar like a guy. In other words, it wasn't like she throws like a girl, you know, people used to do that. And now girls, since they found their equality, you know, have permission to throw the way they want, to play the way they want. Well, Bonnie was a very early pioneer in that. And learning the guitar from the guys, she learned how to play, and she had no inhibitions about that. She refused to be put in a box. And so she just played the way she wanted to play. And being the maverick that she's always been, I think that was incredibly appealing to a lot of people, to women, to go, wow, look at that girl go. So she was an inspiration to women. And to guys were flabbergasted that she could play as well as a guy, in some cases better.
Right, because in 1968, 69, people would be familiar with female vocalists, Janis Joplin, Grace Slick. They might be familiar with folk guitarists, fine ones too, Joni Mitchell, that sort of thing. But to see a rock blues guitar in the hands of a woman was still—it
was unheard.
I can't think of one. I'm sure there are a few, but
well, there weren't any back then. I mean, she really was the first to really do that, and to really play and sing the blues again as a white woman. You know, of course, there were black women who did it, but. Apart from, I guess, you know, Memphis Minnie and a few of the people that the average person didn't know about. So since it's so much of a white world in terms of, particularly then, of what would get mm-hmm. out.
Do you think of Janis as a white blues singer, though?
Well, yes and no. I mean, she didn't sing. In a way, Janis isn't quite as authentic as Bonnie is, and just in terms of the genre, yeah. I mean, and I'm not knocking Janis is an incredible singer, but Janis is more of a belter,
right.
You know, and a rocker with blues influences. And when Bonnie sings the blues, she really, you listen to what some of these guys did, and she's right in there.
Right. She understands the nuances.
Totally.
Can you recall this first album recording sessions? I mean, you can read the liner notes and hear a little bit about how it was done in a, looks like a funky house in Minneapolis on Lake Minnesota. But what do you recall about those sessions, first time recording with Bonnie Raitt?
Well, the first recording with Bonnie Raitt was done in a garage Lake Minnetonka outside of Minneapolis, and it was done on a four-track machine.
Why there?
Well, because Bonnie was a big fan of a record called Running, Jumping, Standing Still by Kerner, Ray, and Glover, and it was produced by Willie Murphy. Now, Willie Murphy was a Minneapolis musician, very versatile Minneapolis musician, very bluesy guy, had a great band called Willie and the Bumblebees, and Bonnie wanted to use Willie. She liked the record, the Kerner Ray and Glover record. And Dave Ray, the Ray of Kerner Ray and Glover, had just started this studio with his Crown four-track machine. And she decided she wanted to do it in a very funky manner. She had kind of contract from Warner Brothers, which allowed her to, gave her a certain amount of money. I believe it was $40,000 at the time. A similar kind of contract with James Taylor had. And she could make a record as long as she could spend that budget any way she wanted, as long as she delivered that record. And she decided that that's the way she wanted to do it. In fact, when she asked me to play with her, when my band was breaking up, I got a call from her in early 1971. And she said, Freeball, I hear your band's breaking up. What are you going to do? I said, well, Dick Waterman asked me if I wanted to play with Buddy Guy, with Buddy and Junior. I'm considering that. And she said, well, I just got this record from record contract from Warner Brothers, and I'd love you to play bass on it, and maybe you can come up to Boston and learn some of my tunes, and we'll do a little guest set, and we can do some gigs along the way. So I did, and learned some tunes, and we did a guest set, and it worked out well, and went and did that record and seven others with her, and that lasted for almost 11 years. So that's the way it got started. So when we had already done some gigs together as a duo,
I see,
and we were a duo for 3 years, just the two of us. It was really a fantastic 3 years, just very free, wonderful. And personally, it helped me. It helped put me in a spotlight right next to her, just the two of us sitting there on stage. And it was really a lot of fun because I could really get into her nuances. And on the fretless bass, I would do a combination of supporting her with a rhythm and of floating with her on the blues nuances and supporting the vocal and playing in between the vocals. So I was kind of like a band. And it was very challenging and very freeing type of thing to do creatively on the bass, and particularly on a fretless bass.
Can you paint a picture of what you gigging in small clubs throughout most of that time, just town to town? Or
well, at that point, record companies were very involved in artist development. And so what they would do, there were clubs like the Troubadour and the Boarding House, Troubadour in Los Angeles, Boarding House in San Francisco, the Gaslight in New York, the Second Fret, the Main Point in Philadelphia, trying to think of the one in Washington, D.C. But there were a lot of these.
Double Door?
Double Door is in... it's in Charlotte, Virginia.
Oh, but it
was,
that's right.
Was it the something
that's,
door?
It's funny
there,
that I
right.
remember because I lived for 8 years in Charlotte. It was, and that's why I called that one up. That's funny.
Cellar Door. It was the Cellar
Door. There you go.
Thank you. That's it.
And
we would...
Saw Brewer and Shipley there. That's how I remember.
Uh-huh. Well, you would play there for an entire week. And a typical, for instance, the Troubadour, and in fact, in all of them, Tuesday night would be your first night generally. And you'd play not two sets, but two shows, first show, second show. And generally the reviewers would come. So the reviewer from the New York Times shows up at your first show before you really have a chance to get your feet wet and get used to things. But that's where the review comes out. And, of course, it holds up for the rest of the week. And we would open up clubs like that. In quite a few cases, we opened up for Jackson Browne. And it was just Jackson Browne, David Lindley as a duo, and Bonnie and myself as a duo. Quite a few places we opened up for John Prine. We opened up for Paul Butterfield and his Better Days. We would swap with Little Feet. Sometimes we'd open for them, and eventually got to the point where they'd open for us.
This is where that whole fraternity is starting to develop, isn't it?
Exactly, particularly in Los Angeles. And the record company would support it. So you would play basically two shows, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, three shows Friday, three shows Saturday, and two shows on Sunday. And then you'd move to the next place and do the same thing again. And it's a wonderful way for an audience to see an artist in an up-close personal environment like that. And opening, the concept of having an opening act, which is really a wonderful way to get exposure. People come to see the main act and they wind up seeing you as well. It was a very nurturing time in the music industry and a great way to put it together. And I think one of the reasons that the music industry is not what it was is because that concept has been lost and filled up with the concept of, you know, the quick buck, the quick fix, you know, the concept of greed, and of course a lot of people thrown in with nepotism, yeah, and
shortest distance between two points.
Yeah, that's a whole other story. Yeah. But I think it's pertinent in terms of what's happened to the music that gets out there to the average person. So back in that day, the record companies were very supportive, and Warner Brothers was very good to Bonnie. And I think it's why these Warner Brothers records are so good. There's a lot of heart in them, and a lot of support from a lot of different levels. So you would play that entire week, and everybody would really get to know each other, and there'd be a lot of press, and it really, really helped create a buzz. And so certainly the first year I was with her were mostly gigs like this, and occasionally, you know, concerts and opening for people. I remember we did one with Jim Croce, mm-hmm. When it was Jim and what was his partner's name? They both got killed in the plane crash.
Yeah, I can't recall.
Guitar player.
Yeah.
Beautiful guy. It was really tragic. So got to meet a lot of people that opened up gigs with John Hammond.
I'll bet.
And then eventually got to the point where, and in many cases, Bonnie would really be the star of the show because, again, she was so special. And she'd sit there with this incredible voice, but it was the phenomenon of listen to this woman sing blues and play the blues, even though she was doing other things. We did an Elton John song, did a lot of different kinds of things. We did a Steve Winwood song, but I think it was the concept is this beautiful voice that's singing with the blues nuances and playing this bottleneck slide guitar, which, again, was unheard of for a woman to do. Yeah.
Well, I know it's been years, and I don't know how often you revisit these records. You know, it would be presumptuous to think that you would at all, even. But if, as you look at the titles on this first album, could you maybe pick a couple that jump out as memorable for you in the band playing and talking about what makes them dynamic pieces of music? You know, just pick a couple things out. You know, I mean, I know you could pick a lot of detail out, but...
Well, first of all, looking on Bonnie's first record, I look at the back and I see everybody out there by the garage with Junior Wells and A.C. Reed, Jimmy Reed's lesser-known brother but equally talented, and all of the Bumblebees and Willie and Bonnie's brother Steve and...
So you're looking at family there.
And myself with a tuba, holding a tuba.
All right.
And... In the family, it was a very family type of situation. I mean, we lived together for a month doing this record. And, you know, we'd work during the day, and often at night we'd go out to the club and play and have a great time and jam. And the Bumblebees were a great band. So Willie was the bass player in the Bumblebees. And so it was pretty much the Bumblebees and me as the bass player, and Bonnie, of course. I look at some of these songs, Danger, Heartbreak, Dead Ahead, which was just a rocking kind of a thing, and Bluebird, Stephen Stills' Bluebird, which we did with a whole different arrangement.
Feel free to pause on any one, and, you know, if details come to mind, because what's nice in these programs is if before I play a track that they hear someone with an intimate knowledge of it saying, what's cool to listen for in this or what I remember about this. And then playing it, it's kind of like taking them through a museum. You know what I mean?
Well, what's interesting about the songs on this first record of Bonnie's is everything was recorded live. So everything you hear, there's a vibe to it, and that's what she wanted to do. She wanted it to be live. So a lot of these are not the first take. They're, you know, maybe the fourth, fifth, sixth take until we could really get the arrangement down. And again, recorded on a four-track machine. So every instrument didn't have its own track. So sometimes you hear more of one thing, a little less of another, but the basic vibe really, really stands out. And I remember being in my little cubby hole. You know, when you record in one room, everybody has baffles, they're called. And I remember just being there and just kind of focusing on Bonnie and focusing on the band and kind of trying to get things together, you know, in my perfectionistic kind of way. And when it happened, it was really cool. And I know in Danger, Heartbreak, Dead Ahead, it really rocks. And also in Since I Fell for You, just a very, very sweet, sweet song that I don't think anybody sings, you know, better than Bonnie.
So now here's an example, though, someone you've spent some time talking about her ability to deliver the blues in a very sophisticated, nuanced way. And yet there's so many examples of her work with a ballad on many albums that that's a different type of singing, but she delivers that as well.
Well, it is a different type of singing, but where the blues enters into that is not as much in the musical genre as in the emotional availability. And the blues is all about emotion. The blues is all about the human drama. And the blues are usually about, in general, most of the songs are about, how could they do this to me? You know, it's a somewhat victim oriented. But when done right, it's not just about, it doesn't come off as martyr-like in terms of victimness. It just comes off in terms of the hurt, in terms of the pain. And I think the pain that's in the blues inherently from where it came from the cotton fields and the enslavement, I think Bonnie picked up on that too. And I think she channeled that, and she channeled the emotion of that in all of her singing. So when you hear her sing a ballad, she takes her beautiful voice, she takes her musicality, she takes the words, and she bends them. She does some of the blues things. They may not be musically blues nuances, but it's emotional blues nuances. And she takes that emotion and she just milks it, and she squeezes every drop of emotion out of it. And that's what translates when you hear a song like I Can't Make You Love Me or Since I Fell For You or any of the songs that emote pain. There's nobody better than Bonnie to do that. And by the same token, when she sings with joy and a song of joy, Bonnie's a very emotional person, and she can experience joy. And she experiences everything on a very high level. She's a very intense person. She's a triple Scorpio for you astrologers out there. And so she's very intense. And so when she's really happy, she's really happy. And when she's sad, she's really sad. And she's found a way to be emotionally available in her music. And that's what really connects to people. So when Bonnie sings a ballad, it tears your heart out.
Just to explain, too, this series is called The Emergence of Paul Simon, Bob Dylan, Bonnie Raitt. So just as an organizing structure, not to overlook the long arc of a person's career, we just sort of focus on the sort of moments when they come out and get noticed. In her case, you know, as I do with Paul Simon, it's probably going to be like a couple of chapters. You know, it's like the initial introduction and then her reemergence in the 80s. But when you think about this first arc of three or four albums, before I leave the point that you just made about the joy, is there a song or two from those earlier albums where that is clearly on display?
The joy?
Yeah, you said when she's really sad, she's really sad, and that serves her well in the ballads and any of the first albums, you know.
Well,
I know what you're talking about, but I'm wondering what jumps to mind for you.
Well, my favorite album of all her albums is Give It Up, which is the second one, and I look at some of the titles on there, Give It Up or Let Me Go. I mean, that comes from somewhat of a victim place, but it also comes from a place of strength. And that's emoted in the music and the way Bonnie sings it. And I can hear just by looking at the title, I mean, I play tuba on it. It's a very kind of a fun, happy song. And that's what she does. She takes the joy of the music, and that joy in the music almost turns the victim mentality of the song into a strength, into a positive thing. Also in, let's see, cut number three, I know you don't love me no more, no more, no more. And just a wonderful, fun song. And Bonnie has such a good time with it. I mean, you can hear in her vocal, and it was live. She's just having a blast being there.
Yeah.
And you feel that. And I think that's another thing that made her really, really popular. Under the Falling Sky, which is a Jackson Brown song. Great song. In fact, I'm particularly I'm particularly attracted to that because most of the guys are in the Edison Electric Band, except for the drummer, T.J. Tindall, who actually, when we broke up, he played a lot of things with Gamble and Huff. He played a lot of those Gamble and Huff hits, Spinners, the OJs, and Mark Jordan on piano. And when we broke up, he went with Van Morrison and then with Dave Mason and played with Jackson Browne, played with a lot of people. So it was a pretty talented band, and it was great to get us all together on Under the Falling Sky. So it was basically the Edison Electric Band, a drummer, Wells Kelly, who was a drummer with Orleans, and Paul Butterfield on harmonica. And that track just smokes like crazy.
And it's an example of a track that, you know, essentially is pretty quiet in its original iteration with Jackson Browne.
Whole different arrangement from right. the way Jackson did it.
Yeah.
Which emanated from, and of course I'd like to take some credit for it, but it's really Bonnie who came up with the basic arrangement. You know, as a bass player, I can come and add my thing and kind of help really make it work and bring the pieces together with it. But Bonnie heard Jackson's original version and said, I'd like to do a more rockin' version of that. And rock it does.
So Give It Up or Let Me Go is a Bonnie Raitt original. She wasn't a prolific writer at this stage of her career, but can you talk a little bit about her emergence as a writer?
Well, Bonnie wrote two songs on the, two songs on the first record, Thank You and Finest Lovin' Man. And then I think on the second one, she does Nothing Seems to Matter, is hers, I know, and Give It Up, actually the first two songs. And no, she wasn't a prolific songwriter. I mean, she didn't do a whole lot of songwriting. I don't know if she did any on the third and fourth albums. That wasn't until later on, I think, she did more writing and co-writing. But I think it was probably empowering for her to do that and know that she could do it. And, you know, and they're good songs. They're good songs, and I'm not quite sure why she chose not to write after that. I think she considered herself an interpreter of other people's songs, and I think she did a really good job of bringing lesser-known writers into the mainstream. People like Chris Smither, who's a wonderful artist, and Eric Kaz, and even Jackson. Jackson was doing just fine, but she did other things with Jackson's songs. And Paul Siebel, whom very few people had heard of. So I think she probably didn't write as much because she got just as much pleasure and joy from exposing and discovering some of the many great songs that are out there, and they still are. There are just so many wonderful songs being written that you rarely hear on mainstream radio. So Bonnie deserves a lot of credit for helping to do that and for interpreting these songs and bringing them to the public's attention.
Now, a long time ago, again, I know, but I'm just imagining the Give It Up or Let It Go session. That's that song. I mean, there's so many fun elements, the whole Dixieland band thing, and it's such a wonderful amalgam of styles. Can you talk about that song a little bit more for me?
Well, I think that the amalgam of styles is something that I know is something that Bonnie and I had a great affinity for, both of us, and I think why we're attracted to each other, because we're both very eclectic in our tastes. And I think if, you know, back then, you know, both being products of the music of the 40s, the 50s, the 60s, musical comedy, all the great Richard Rodgers and Hammerstein, all those wonderful musicals that her dad was a part of, great musical tradition, the folk tradition that she was very much into, in both musically and stylistically, as well as thematically, you know, her politics, which are phenomenal and very dedicated. And then her discovery and love of the blues, and then of rhythm and blues and all the Motown stuff, and also of rock and roll. So we were all exposed to those things. And I think very typical of Bonnie, she refused to be put in a box. Again, she's always marched to the beat of her own drum. And these early records in particular really show that. She says, I want to do a song like this. And I remember when she first, I had mentioned tuba, that I played tuba in the high school band. She said, you play tuba? I said, yeah, well, I did. It's been a while. She said, oh, man, you got to play tuba on the record. And I went, well, that'd be fine. I don't have a tuba. We'll find you one. You know, we've got to.
You know, we've got a budget.
Yeah, but played tuba on Big Road on the first one, and on Give It. I've actually played tuba on each of Bonnie's records, as I play tuba on each of my own records too. But it's
including her latest.
What's that?
Including her latest. Silver Lining. You played.
Yeah, I played tuba on a cut on that, which was a nice little reunion. But I mean, that's the thing about Bonnie, about refusing to be put in a box and being eclectic and saying, you know what, I'm just going to come from my heart. And she always has come from her heart on every level. And that's also what makes her so appealing and so genuine. And it totally, so what you see in her music is just a reflection of who she really is.
I want to be sensitive to your need to get on the road, because this could go on for hours, I know. But let me just toss another couple or three things out, and then we'll close up. As you're describing this eclecticism, I'm imagining that on the road with Bonnie Raitt in rehearsals, before and after, on the bus or whatever, that there's still a lot of playing going on, and there's a lot of calling out of songs. Do you remember this? And that a lot of these covers might have, you know, gotten their genesis in just sessions where you guys are sitting around, someone's calling out tunes. Is that an accurate imagination of mine, or is it, how did it unfold? Am I making that up for my own benefit?
The short answer, yes, you're making it up for your own benefit.
Okay, yes, that's clear. No. Okay, so what was it like?
It was nothing like that, actually. I think it was a combination of that stuff. There was always a lot of music going on and listening to it. I mean, ultimately, Bonnie is the captain of her own ship, and she makes her own decisions, and she's pretty firm about that. She's definitely in control, but she's very good at taking the influences and the energies around her. So it's hard to say exactly what song came from where or from when. But I think it's a combination of the sitting around the bus and her sitting around at home, and people sending her songs and her listening and choosing what she wants to do. And I think some people would say that there were some songs that sent to her that were excellent songs that she chose not to do. Probably not because they weren't excellent songs, but probably because that wasn't the emotional place she was in at that moment. And I think her records in general, especially back then, very much reflect where she was at. And the fact that they're so eclectic, not just musically, but eclectic emotionally, shows her range of emotions. And I think she wanted to present a balanced picture of who she is. And I think in the process of all these records, I think she really has. So where exactly they came from, it's hard to say, but she did a lot of listening, and we all did a lot of that. And my guess, it's just an amalgamation of all of that.
Right. So as you think about sort of the early phase, the first handful of records, if you I'm sort of giving you or asking you to take the opportunity to say to an audience, you got to check this tune out, and here's why. You know, a couple that come to mind that represent to you some core element of what makes Bonnie Raitt important.
Well, I would say what makes her important musically, besides the fact that she was the first girl, the first white girl to sing the blues and play the blues the way she did. And I don't mean to, you know, disparage anyone who might have done it before her, but certainly the first one that I knew, or that seemed like most of the viewers knew, or that the world as I knew it knew. And I think she's been incredibly influential. I mean, had Bonnie not come along, a lot of people who followed would not have followed. So she deserves a tremendous amount of credit in terms of that. But looking again at the Give It Up record, Stay Too Long at the Fair is one of my favorite songs. And what's interesting, I mean, that's a really out-of-the-box kind of a song.
What do you mean?
Well, from the title to the lyrics, a fellow named Joel Zoss wrote it. And very interesting character. Just musically and lyrically, it's just not your typical song. It's not a typical ballad. It's not a blues song. It's not a rhythm and blues song. It's a singer-songwriter song. And this is in the fairly early days of singer-songwriters. And again, Bonnie taking those songs and interpreting them and putting them out there. And the song is a little bit folk. It's a little bit rock. It's musically very eclectic. And it's very emotional song. I mean, it pours out, you know, stayed too long at the fair, been up too late, just, you know, you go past the apex of the curve, and we've all been there on anything, whether it be in a relationship or that moment in your life, you know, you're feeling despair or sadness. And again, Bonnie's so good at emoting that. And a song like that, I mean, and so often it would be done in a blues tune or in a straight-ahead ballad. This is not really a ballad. It's kind of a rock ballad, but it's not really rock. And it just falls in between the cracks. It's Bonnie Raitt, and it's really unique. A song like Love Has No Pride. A beautiful song, and there's nobody in the world who can sing it. In my opinion, anything like Bonnie, who can just emote the emotion of that song and put you in that place, you know, where you don't feel like it's a victim, but you feel empathy for the person who's singing the song. You don't feel sympathy, you feel empathy, and you feel compassion for them. And it, being empathetic, it takes you to your own feelings.
I could be there, in other words.
I could be there, I have been there. And even if I haven't, I know what that feels like. And here's somebody who's expressing my pain. And I think that was very attractive to a lot of people. She expressed their pain, and she expressed their joy. So she helped express a lot of people's emotions who didn't know how to express them themselves. And so it became very personal in a very unique way, because this was the early days of the singer-songwriter. Yeah. And Bonnie had a way of doing that based off, the blues genre, the blues background, which is about expressing pain and singing about it. She took it to a whole nother level. And so that's why her ballads are, and even the semi-ballads, I say, Till the Fair, are so incredibly effective at communicating that.
Excellent. Anything that you want to tell me that I just shouldn't miss about thinking about Bonnie?
Yeah, I would... About Bonnie's politics, Bonnie Raitt, more than anybody else I know, maybe with the exception of Jackson Browne, just musically, really puts her money where her mouth is, literally and figuratively. And Bonnie, coming from the Quaker tradition, she was raised in the Quaker tradition. She went to some Quaker schools, and the Quakers are all about peace. I went to Quaker school. I went to Swarthmore. And it's an amazing tradition. And between the Quaker tradition of peace and of nonviolence and the early folk movement that Bonnie was in, and my guess is that she was attracted to the folk thing probably because of the Quaker thing, she got involved early on in politics, and not in the actual politics as much of voting, but the politics of, for instance, women's issues. She was very early on. She was into the women's issues of women's equality, and she would show up and she would be part of that movement. But what she did more than anything is she walked the walk. She was an independent woman. And she was a leader of her situation, and she was not going to be diminished by any man. And probably also why she decides she's going to play the guitar the way she's going to play the guitar. And so the whole thing goes into her personality and her politics and her commitment to social justice. We were very involved in the no nukes movement, in terms of energy, in terms of things that, of course, are becoming, you know, very much to the fore now, with the global warming, climate change, and things getting closer to the tipping point. Bonnie was in it very, very early on, and I can certainly thank her a lot on a personal level for helping to turn me on to a lot of those issues. I was somewhat involved, was very much involved in the anti-Vietnam War issues, but she really turned me on to some of the more subtle things, in particular in terms of women's issues. And so her political commitment has been very strong and very firm from the time she began playing, and she's always done a bunch of benefits. And you don't really hear it in her music. It's interesting. She doesn't do the songs about it. She does in terms of women's issues, in terms of strength, standing up in relationships. But she shows up at all the events. And the other thing that I really respect about Bonnie is that she gives credit to the people from whom she got her musical roots. She always gives credits to the blues people who went through this pain, who invented this music that she copped. And she cops to the fact that she copped it. Of course, she turned it into her own hybrid, but she never says it's mine. She says, I got it from them. And she's been very, very gracious and generous in her accolades toward them. And in her generosity, as well as having a lot of the blues people open shows for her and paying them well and helping to get their music out there. Sippy Wallace would be a great example. And some of the Sippy Wallace songs that are on the on the first record, Woman Be Wise, which is just a classic. And on the second one, I think You Got to Know How. And just show Bonnie's fun side. But these are actually political songs in terms of women's issues and women asserting themselves in relationships. So I can just say that I have the greatest respect for Bonnie in terms of those two things, and her politics continue to this day, where she does put her money where her mouth is, and she does show up, and she is on the front lines of the issues that she cares about, and that's very rare in today's world. And hallelujah, Bonnie.
Freebo, thank you for being gracious and generous with your thoughts, talking with us about Bonnie Raitt.
My pleasure, man. Thank you.
Great. Good luck to you.
Thank you.